Welcome, listeners, to another fantastic bonus episode of Oh My Word Podcast. Today we have this very special guest, a writer, editor, and editor encompasses a lot of things which we're going to get to, so just hang on, everyone. We're going to get to everything. But let's please welcome Rebecca Kleppner to the podcast. Welcome.
Hello.
Thanks for being here today. We appreciate your attendance, your participation. So here we go. Let's just start. We always like to start from the beginning with everyone. And we'll start with writing first. Then if the editing answer kind of overlaps, that we'll do that too. How did you become a writer? Why did you decide that you want to become a writer?
So I was one of those people who grew up and, you know, read a lot. I was like the type of kid who'd like read the book I was like wanting to read as opposed to the book I was supposed to read for homework.
Yeah.
And I would get in trouble all the time for that, you know.
Yep.
Oh, I went to bed at 1 o'clock in the morning. Why? Because I had to read one more page. Okay, so I was that kid. But like writers seem to be some kind of magical being that lived above the plane of our lower existence. And the idea of me being an actual writer was like one of those things I might fantasize but never actually seem possible. I actually wrote a lot, which is like, that's the funny thing, is I didn't think of myself as a writer, but like I was like writing and contributing to the high school literary magazine, and I was like the assistant editor of the magazine, and then I wrote on the school newspaper in college, and I wrote, I picked a major that was like one where we wrote a lot of papers. So I was writing a lot, but like the idea of writing like fiction, like stories, that was like not something that I ever thought that I would do. And then I kind of moved from anthropology into teaching because it was like one of these multi-step things, which makes sense if you explain in detail, but kind of seems abrupt. But
okay.
I was teaching, and one of my students I had that I was tutoring after school, I made her write a journal entry multiple days a week. And at one point, she was not doing them, and she said, why should I write a journal entry and have to bring something in? You should have to write a journal entry, too. So every time after that, where I expected her to write a journal entry, I had to write a journal entry. But it wasn't like a journal entry like, this is what happened today. It was like, it could sometimes be like a short story or a poem or something. So one time I brought in a story, and she was like, that's a really good story. So I polished it up, found out, like, what do you have to do in order to submit a story to a publisher? And I actually sent it to a publisher. Oh. And the publisher rejected it, but, like, rejected it with, like, one of these kind of gently encouraging kind of rejection letters.
Huh.
So I thought, oh, well, that's not so bad. So I did a little bit more research, and then I wrote another story. And that story actually ended up getting, like, selected by them.
Wow.
It was like one of those things that's really random. Like it was like really with very little knowledge. But here's the thing. She saw something in that story, but it really was not of like the most professionally produced story because there's a lot of things going on in every genre and for every audience. And I did not, like I followed so many, I broke so many of the rules I should have been following for writing a picture book. And so subsequently, I had to, like, before you get the book published, you have to go through multiple drafts.
Right.
So she had me make multiple revisions, and it took a particularly long time to get that picture book out because they were looking for, like, just the right illustrator. And when I sold the story, I had a child. I was pregnant with the next child.
Wow.
Like, it was two pregnancies. So it's like, okay, so, you know, like, it's over 2 years. When the final draft came in, so it was really interesting because it was like, at a certain point, I was like, fine, you made this last-minute change. I don't even care anymore. Just get it, make it gone. So I thought I had done this thing, and it was really cool, and it was really enjoyable, and I was excited about it, and I had continued to practice writing, and I had been continuing trying to find out more about writing. But at that point in time, I was like mostly like a stay-at-home mother, and I was doing a little bit of work here and there, like tutoring on the side, but that I really wasn't doing anything. And then when the book came out, I realized I had a lot more ideas, and I started learning more about writing, and then, like, from then on, like, my career kind of, it took a long time for the next book to come out, but I started, published a lot of things for periodicals, like magazines and on websites and things like that.
Oh, wow. So, now that you're a writer, do you feel like you're part of these mystical beings that exist above the plane of regular human beings? You're just like, oh, we're still regular people.
No, but I definitely am weirder than other human beings. Like, I feel like writers definitely see the world in a slightly different way, at least fiction writers do, than other people. And sometimes I say things, some of the things that fiction writers do a lot, like, I would say them to my husband. He's like, do you tell other people that what you just told me? Because if somebody just randomly told me that thing, I would be worried about that. Because, like, the whole idea of, like, sometimes your characters start talking to you in your head.
Yeah.
And they're talking with each other.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's like, are you sure there's nothing wrong with you? I was like, there's nothing wrong with me. I promise.
Yeah. I'm just a writer.
Yeah. So, yes.
Well,
definitely, I feel like a writer, but I don't feel like some kind of magical being.
Aw. Oh, I guess we can't have everything. How does that compare? Like writing for a book versus writing for a periodical. Is that better or not better? Or did?
Oh, it's so interesting. So that's the thing. It's really interesting. So when you're writing a book, the process is so extremely long. First of all, unless the book is a picture book, the actual physical process of writing is longer.
Right.
And then there's the editing process. And then if you're going to go through a traditional publishing situation, then you have so many steps along the way. Like if you're getting an agent, you have to query. If not, you're still submitting to publishers. And every step just takes a really long time. And so you're talking about years often.
Yeah.
And then not only that, once the book comes out, the book comes out. Now it's going to be a while before you hear from any fans, right, about
right.
how they feel about the book. So you don't get that kind of pleasure. And then financially, because now it's like this is my, you know, part of my livelihood, it takes a long time to get the money because of the way contracts are scheduled. Like, you have to wait for like 6 months for them to tally the sales, and then it's months after that before you get the check for the previous period. It's just
right.
like a really long time.
Right.
And so it's like, so it's like it's a lot about delayed gratification, but it's more lasting, and it's like you get kind of different level of devotion. When you're writing for periodicals, you have to figure out, there's a lot of like figuring out what columns are carried in which publications, because I do a lot of also things like book reviews and personal essays and things like that too. So you have to figure out who's carrying what kind of material. What is the word count that they prefer? Who's the editor of that department? There's a lot of like information that you have to acquire upfront.
Right.
But then when you write it, the writing itself is much faster. The writing itself is published much faster.
Right.
And then you get all sorts of very interesting feedback, especially if you're writing for an online publication, because a lot of times, like immediately, you'll start seeing whether people share what you're writing. Where people will comment on the publication's main page. Like, it's just really interesting. And then the payment is just, like, so fast.
Wow.
So much faster.
Wow.
So it's, like, it's like, the writing itself might not differ that much, but the results are so, it's, like, almost comparing apples to oranges. And I think there's certain aspects of each that really, like, they're complementary. Like, if you are only writing books, it's much harder to count on that as like an income flow. Whereas if you're writing books and you're publishing things that you're getting paid more regularly, if you're building a career, or if you have fans who are constantly wanting new little things along the way because they want that, like the new thing in an amount of time that's like it's much too little time for you to come out with new works for them to read is their books.
Right.
Then it's like, it's a nice balance to have, to be able to produce both kinds of things. There's also a couple things that for writers I think are really good in periodicals, which is that having those really short word counts makes you really, really learn how to make all the words count.
Huh.
And it's really, really good for certain kinds of revising. Like the type of person who tends to be long-winded will learn how to cull those extra words as they're like tightening everything up. It's also really good because you get deadlines that are very firm, and it kind of, for some people, it's like otherwise they'll procrastinate. But when you have a date that you have to hit, and you know that if you don't hit it on time, you might not get paid.
Right.
It's very motivating.
Yeah.
And so it helps me get a really strong writing habit.
Oh, that's good. But what about as far as the story is concerned, if you're writing something that's playing out over a couple weeks or, you know, however long, do you know the story up front and then you're just parceling it out, or do you kind of wing it?
So I have the personality of a person who really likes to plan things. Like, I can be flexible, but I like to have some kind of plan going in.
Uh-huh.
So it was really interesting. One of the jobs I had was where they had themed issues for each edition of that particular magazine. This was a print magazine for children. And I was given the theme, and 3 weeks later, I had to turn in the story.
Wow.
And, like, there were, like, I don't know, like, four of us or something in the writing stable, so we were rotating. So it was, like, once a month. Oh, and also sometimes things would happen, like, the regular writer would, like, ooh, have a baby 2 months early or something like that. That happened once.
Oh,
and
man.
So suddenly it's, like, can you produce a story in 10 days?
Huh.
So you have massive time pressure. So, but they've given you the theme. And so also because I had been a teacher, like, they teach you a lot of pre-writing activities. So I would, like, brainstorm, come up with some ideas. I would do the, like, they have some exercises for writers of, like, the kind where you take one, like, seemingly normal idea, but then you, like, add some really strange outside, like, coming out of left field idea to combine with it. So now your idea that was, like, really seemingly not quite boring, but, like, pretty predictable, now has this unpredictable element. Or I would think about, like, what would cause the most conflict for a person who's thinking about this particular theme or something. So I would then take that idea, and then I would usually write out a very brief outline, and I would write to that outline. And, like, for the length of stories, I would usually write, like, I knew, like, how many scenes I would need for the story, for example. So I would need to have, like, three scenes, and you have to start when you're writing, like, for a short story, you got to start right there, first page, within, right, like, the first couple paragraphs, you need conflict. So I knew I'd have to establish that early. And then I just got into this, like, groove where you just really, but you have to, like, think of it as, like, breaking it down and stuff, because if somebody says, just write me this story by a certain date, some people will just be able to wing it. Those people, they're pantsers, they are really good at winging things, they can do that, but to me, that's, like, a lot of pressure. But if I break each step of it, the brainstorming part, the planning part, and then the writing part into different steps, and each one somehow is more achievable.
Did you have to tell them where your story was going to go or anything like that? Or they're just happy because they trust you as a writer or because they like your writing? It's just like, you know what we're, the kind of stuff that we're publishing, you have the theme, figure something out.
So it's really interesting because when you get a gig like that, you have to usually write a few things ahead of time, and then they like kind of test you out, and you try a few things. And then at a certain point, they give you a lot more leeway, and they'll go to bat for you.
Uh-huh.
And if something's not working, they'll let you know. And if you have a really good relationship with the editor, then usually they will say, this is the problem we're having. What do you think are some solutions?
Uh-huh.
Because remember, we talked... Oh, yeah, we haven't actually talked about this yet.
Yeah.
But when we talk about editing, one of the things that's, like, really important is making sure that in the editing process, you still maintain the author's own voice. So if you have an editor who's very intrusive, then they can say, like, well, there's a problem with this story. And I've had this actually happen one time so badly that I afterwards got fans sending me letters like, you didn't write the last sentence of that paragraph, did
wow.
you, in the last line of the story.
Yeah.
And basically, they'll be like, you see, there's a problem. We're just going to slap this extra sentence or swap this one thing out for something else and not even tell you until it actually goes to print. And wow, that's like, you kind of feel like somebody just roughed you up. Like, you know, when you're in school and, like, some kid got mad at you and just starts, like, smacking you around the face. Yeah, that's what it feels like. You're like, that
wow.
was my story. What did you just do to me?
Right, right. Well, because it's also like, if I'm the writer, why do you not trust me to fix it? Like, didn't you hire me because I'm the writer?
Yeah, exactly. But it's just interesting because some people, I guess, maybe they don't trust you as much. Or some people, you know, like, sometimes, like, there's new writers and there's also new editors. And
right.
one time it was a new editor who was there because, you know, like, almost everybody on staff was on vacation. They lived in New York. And it was, like, the time of year where a lot of people go out to the Catskills or, like, up to the White Mountains or whatever. And, yeah, that person, like, overreached a little bit.
So, well, you know, we may as well use this as a transition now to speak about editing, because you do that as well. And so how did you, I guess it sounds like writing came first, then editing came after. How did you make that transition to be an editor also?
Well, the editing is really, so that's a really funny thing. So, yeah, as I said, when I was talking about how I started writing, when I was in high school, I was already doing some editing work on a limited basis. When I was in, like, I was the person second in command, I guess, at the helm of the literary magazine. So I did a little bit of editing then. And then I got edited for the next several years in college, and it was really interesting. I helped some of my classmates also with writing. I just always was a very strong writer. So some of my classmates, I would help them with their papers. And I also, as I was being edited, I had this one, it was really funny, I actually absolutely detested as a person the editor in question. This is like the guy who was for 2 years when I was in college. He was the head of the newspaper, but he was an amazing editor. He was amazing. Okay. He had real clarity when he was looking at the text. And so I learned a lot by watching him. And then what ended up happening is I was sending in pieces, like little things like book reviews and occasionally like local news type things for a small local publication. And they had a copy editor. And the copy editor was awful. Like, she was actually really good at other kinds of editing because I've seen other things that she had done. She was excellent at. And for other kinds of writing, she probably would have been really good. But she was not originally from the U.S., and she had not done, like, I don't think she had done, like, news-style editing in the U.S. So I think she may have worked for more, like, academic-type publications or something. And everything, she did the thing where she actually would turn your stuff into passive voice.
Oh, man.
And she would do these things where instead of making things be quick and direct, she would make everything more convoluted.
Oh no.
So I turned my stuff in, and I was like, when I would get back, I was like just really, really frustrated. And other of the writers also were frustrated. And she was actually a really great lady. Like, as I said, she was actually, like, I had seen some books that she edited. She was really good at what she did for books. Really good. And, but it was just interesting that at a certain point, I think she may have gotten married or something. Something happened where she needed to at least take a break. She wasn't sure if she was coming back from the copy editing job she was doing, and they needed somebody. And I said, hey, I'll do it, even if it's just temporary. And once I got the job, I just was, like, there for a while. And because I already was doing developmental editing, but at that point for my, with picture books and things like that, but, like, not so intensely. It just kind of, the two things, when you're working with picture books, a lot of times what you'll do is the developmental editor will also do the copy editing, but then they'll also, you need, this is actually very important for anybody who self-publishes, you always get a proofreader for the very final copy of the document that goes to the printer, always. But like, so sometimes I would do it for that, so now it's like, the job has now expanded, and thank God it's like something I enjoy. It's like, as I said, it's like when you get, some people, like, have a flavor for language, like a taste for language. Like, it's just, like, words themselves make them really excited. And that's me. So, like, you know, finding the precise combination of phrasing and, like, moving the punctuation around to be slightly more expressive is just, like, makes me so excited. And, like, kind of, you know, a piece of chocolate gets me less excited. And I like chocolate. I mean, I just love you. Manipulating language on that level.
You're definitely a different kind of person. So now that you did mention with the proofreading, so let's kind of explain the difference, because I think a lot of people think of editors as proofreaders, but proofreaders are just there to look.
The average person doesn't. So we're going to talk about different kinds of editing. So,
yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to do it in the order that the writer is going to really be introduced to them.
First person is
your developmental editor. If you're in, a publication that's like a periodical or something, then a lot of times at that point, it's going to be occasionally the managing editor or the department editor is going to talk to you. And you basically, they're going to look at what did the text accomplish? Is the pacing correct? Is it structurally correct? Is there, like, if it's fiction or if it's a narrative nonfiction, they're going to want to make sure that there's enough obstacles, that the stakes are high enough, that the characterization is believable, things like that. Okay, so it's like, this is like more touchy-feely kind of stuff, but you have to have like a real sense of like what speed does the story need to be told at, what are the major components of the story. That's your developmental editing. Okay, then you go down, you have the, like, line-by-line editor. That one, they start moving around paragraphs. They start telling you we're going to cut this section here. We're going to move this other thing around. You need to have a different example in this place. Like, things that are, like, right on the level of the language.
Right.
And they'll have you make changes. Then you go down, and that's where the copy editor comes in. Copy editor is also probably going to move some things around, like, say you have three sentences in a paragraph of five sentences, and they all start with the same word. They're going to start moving around clauses to make the sentence structure not so parallel.
Right.
They're going to make sure that you pick the right kinds of punctuation, even if it's not the same level as proofreading. You're going to, like, sometimes think about, is the phrasing correct? Like, they're going to do fact-checking at that point. They're going to look if there's a style guide for, like, the periodical or for that publishing house. They're going to make sure, like, every single time you use that word is spelled the same way and you're not using variants that are regional or transliterated from another language differently. It's like, it's a kind of, it's like almost proofreading, but there's a lot of other things you're also looking for. And then the final thing you're going to have is that proofreader. And like I said, the last thing you want is to be, because a lot of people will be like, copy editing is not good enough. You always want to hire the proofreader to look at the very final document that goes to print. And the people who find, like, extra things that are missing or wrong in that book, you know, like, oh, look, the word, you know, with just appeared twice on the same page right next to each other.
Right.
That's often because they skip the step of getting the proofreader, because the proofreader, unlike everybody else, everybody else often works together.
Okay.
A lot of times they'll see each other, they'll talk to each other, they may even look multiple times at the same document. The proofreader doesn't usually look at the document until it shows up on their desk. And as a lot of people know from looking at their own work, sometimes you have mistakes that go through because you've seen the same documents so many times that your brain is just like, you know what's supposed to be there, so your brain kind of assumes it's there, right?
Yep.
If you don't have that level of anticipation because you've seen it before, now you're catching things like, oh, look, there's two little periods there. Ooh. Oh, look, there's two spaces between those words. You, like, notice things that you wouldn't otherwise notice had you seen the document before. So having that last step, especially for somebody who does self-publishing, is, like, super, super essential. The proofreader is, like the icing on the cake that you really, really need. It's not, it's like, you know how sometimes there's like a cake and the cake tastes okay by itself, but like with the combination with the icing, it's perfect. You know, like the rest of the editing is not like the cake that doesn't, you know, taste great without the icing. You have to have the icing too on this cake.
Right. Because your proofreader, in short, doesn't touch the story. Those are all your editors do that. The proofreader is just looking at the actual presentation. Yeah.
Exactly. It's just looking for your punctuation. You're making sure your tenses are correct, all that stuff.
Right, well. Yeah, that's a good point, because if it goes out without that, it doesn't seem professional when you get, because that seems so basic to writing, to get, you know, to get the tenses correct or to make sure that, you know, you don't have three that's or something, which when you're writing, it's not because you don't know what you're doing, it's just because writing mistakes are made.
Oh, yeah, and also even when you're at the copy editing level, you'll do that thing sometimes, as I said, where you'll, like, take things out or you'll move things around. And a lot of that behavior, it, like, leaves residue behind, because sometimes once you did that, you cut that thing out, but now there's a period in a place you don't need a period anymore because you moved everything around.
Right.
So it's really important to have that last set of eyes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and just going back to the editing a second, also because you mentioned it, I think a lot of writers especially, have a fear of editors. I've even gotten questions from non-writers about, in regard to editing, like, oh, does your editor change what you're writing? Like, I think everyone has this fear that an editor is going to, you know, the editor is going to come in and just change everything around. That's not going to be your story anymore. So as an editor, how do you make sure that you do preserve the person's story and their voice? What are some of the ways that you go about doing that?
In some cases, it's almost the way when you're writing a story and each character has to have, like, their own different kind of voice in a conversation.
Right.
So a lot of times you're looking at, like, what is the level that they're speaking at. For example, there's some authors who speak with a little bit more authority, and they have a way of speaking that they're writing, and it sounds more like not exactly academic, but it's they have an assumption of like the audience itself is going to have more sophisticated vocabulary and they're very formal. So that's almost like a speaking voice, right?
Right.
And then there's some authors who are like casual, like it's your girlfriend or your best buddy talking to you and confiding to you. So that has like another kind of way of sounding, the different vocabulary, what kinds of words are they going to use, things like that. So there's almost like an ear you develop. And it's interesting because a lot of copy editors and a lot of people who do line-by-line editing aren't writers, and so I don't know how it works for them. But for me, because I think of them as like each of these are different characters talking, I kind of look for the same kinds of things. What kinds of words are they going to use? What kinds of structures are they using? Are they talking to an audience of people who are like their peers and that's like just Joe Schmo on the street? Or is it somebody, are you looking, you know, writing for a publication that's like a higher level, talking about something that's like maybe pertinent to somebody's work or something where there's a certain amount of specialized knowledge already assumed? Like, it's just like the different characters in my head almost.
Oh, that's interesting. And how much of when they do need to make any big edit, you know, it's not just switching around a couple words in a line. How much of that is, this needs to be fixed, this is how it's going to be fixed, or this needs to be fixed, what are your suggestions for fixing it? Or does it depend on the writer you're dealing with?
There's a little bit of difference with you dealing with a book and when you're dealing with a publication, but the number one tip I would have for an author is if you have a deadline you were told to turn something in by, turn it in a little bit early, just a little bit early, because, and then you can say, when will I see the edit on this?
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Right.
And then there's much more time for you to negotiate that kind of thing. Now, if you're doing a book, and even sometimes with a magazine or a website piece, you'll get an edit that's with tracking. So I don't know if the listeners know what track comments is, but like in a Word doc, or even you can have suggested edits, I think is what they call it in like a Google Doc. But you have where the person has made a change, but it highlights the change.
Yeah.
And you can even type a comment of why you changed that thing. Now you can negotiate the change. Like, is this something we really have to do, or is there a different way of fixing it? Sometimes you'll also get things where you'll just get comments, and you just have to address each comment one after another. But a lot of times in books, because there's a little bit longer time frame, you get more of this negotiation. If you do, you want to do it with something that's going to be in a print publication or on a website, I highly, highly recommend turning something in slightly early and mentioning in a gentle kind of way, here's my copy. I'd love to see the editor's comments and revise anything if necessary.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, and then they'll let you do that. They'll say, we thought that you needed the argument needed to be like tied up more tightly at the end of this article,
right,
or something like that. So then you do get the chance to do that.
Well, and you freelance as a developmental editor, and as a copy editor, correct?
Yeah, that's mostly what I do.
So does someone come to you with their novel for, let's say, a developmental edit? What do you need to do now if it's a novel?
Actually, the biggest issue I have with people who come to me is the people who come to me too early in the process.
Uh-huh.
The only reason to come really early in the process is if you really have a lot of loose change and you don't mind paying me to do it to walk you through something. But there's so many different resources that are free or low cost that before you even go to the developmental editor, you should have already done. You should have already gotten feedback from somebody who is not a family member and or is not a really close friend, somebody who's actually going to tell you, this is awful, this is awful.
Uh-oh.
So you need to get, and preferably if somebody who's in the target audience for whatever you're writing.
So you're, by the time they're coming to you, you're looking at something that's way more polished you want to be looking at.
It should be more polished already.
And then what are some of the what are some of the more common things that you usually that you find with a lot of writers that you usually have to edit or correct in developmental editing?
Okay. So the number one thing is, did they start and end the story in the correct place?
Okay.
The best place, this is true both for like an article and for a narrative.
Right.
So if it's a narrative we're talking about, even if it's memoir and it's true, the best advice I have is to follow mice, which a lot of people talk about. It's like Orson Scott Card's, he has this idea of the milieu story, I think it's the information story, C is the next one. C is for character, and E is for, I think, event. Okay?
Okay.
Each of these stories have a place where the story should start and the story should end. So if you use those, these tips, and, like, if you Google it, like, there's also really good stuff by Mary Robinette Cowell. She also elaborates on Orson Scott Card's ideas. It's like mice is, like, I love this thing. It's just, like, a very useful tool to help you. If you're looking for an article, also you have to, there's this concept of the lead, which is usually misspelled by people because it sounds the same as L-E-A-D, but it's a L-E-D-E.
Yep.
And what it is in the first paragraph, you need to have 35 words or less, which tell you what is the person supposed to get out of the article by the end.
Yep.
It's like the main, okay, so you want to, it's just like usually we start a story that's a narrative with the inciting incident. So when you start an article, you want to start really, you have the lead as close to the top as possible. And that really is going to get the person's attention, and they'll know what to expect when they read. And a lot of times that's when they decide whether they're going to skim the article or read the whole thing.
Huh. Interesting.
Wow. So that's like the number one developmental thing is knowing where to start and end something.
Wow.
Another thing is, especially with the narrative, okay, this is the stakes are too low, who cares? That's a problem. And
right.
the person achieves what they want much too easily.
Right, that's not compelling. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot of times also the people are being too nice to the main character. They just want to be nice to their main character because they love their main character. And you should love your characters when you're writing them, or at least empathize with them deeply. But if you love them too much and you protect them, it's like helicopter parenting, except with your fictional characters. I'm helicopter parent your fictional characters. You cannot protect them from everything. All the interesting things that happen to them, that trouble them, that's where the suspense is generated. So you have to, like, it's the opposite of the helicopter parent. It's, you know, like, let them out of the house. Let them go play and get dirty. Like, you have to be like that.
It's like that letting your kids take risks things. Like, let them skateboard.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, so you have to do the same thing when you're writing your characters. Let them out in the world. Let bad things happen to them. Let them toughen up a little bit. That's what you want.
As a writer and editor, when you read, do you find yourself slipping into writer and or editor mode? Or are you able to detach when you're reading and just enjoy a book?
As an editor, I read everything now, and it's really, really, really hard to not edit as I'm going. And so this is actually my biggest complaint about books that have been published, particularly in the last 15 years,
okay,
is that especially, so I happen to absolutely love, as you do, genre fiction, right? The fantasy, the science fiction, I love this. I like rom-coms too, okay?
Okay.
The problem with genre fiction is a lot of times when there's fans, there's a certain amount of fan service happening that because people need to make money, okay, because they need to make a living, and because companies want to make money, okay, for multiple reasons, okay, in order to stay afloat is one of them.
Yeah.
They will try to churn out as many stories as there is an appetite for, right?
Right.
And in some ways, it's because the fans really want it. You want to please your fans, but also, as I said, like, there is a financial aspect to this, too. And so what happens is particularly with an author who has a following already, the quality of the editing, not the writing, the editing, I feel like in a lot of books that have been published has really gone down over the last, like couple decades.
Wow.
And I think it's because people are not taking the time to slowly go over things, and they are afraid to ruffle the feathers of, like, a very popular author because they don't want them to become somebody else's client, so to speak. You know, like, you want to have your, you know, if you've had a good working relationship and been making money off of, you know, this particular very popular author, you don't want them moving to a different publishing house, right?
Right.
So they won't put their foot down when they need to.
Wow.
That's basically how I feel. So, yeah, so I'm sitting there, I'm reading a book, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, oh, my gosh, there was a book. Okay, this book was one of my favorite books that was published in 2019. I read it, like, It was like a couple months ago. It's such a good book. This book, I love this book, love this book. But the, whoever did either the copy editing or the proofreading, at some level, there were things that were so bad. For example, in one paragraph, at the beginning of the paragraph, the person is standing, and yet two sentences later, the person is clearly sitting.
Yes, see, that seems like so...
But there's no them standing and then sitting. Like, they didn't sit down.
Yeah, that's...
As if they have to now get up.
That's like so obvious to catch that, it seems. But I guess if you're not giving it, if you're not paying attention, you're going to miss it. Wow.
Yeah, so, yeah, like, or there'll be like a small factual error. Like, in this book, the action took place... I grew up as a teenager in Vegas. So I'm pretty familiar with, like, where Vegas and, like, Nevada and Utah and Arizona meet. And, like, New Mexico, I've traveled to New Mexico a couple times. So I know this area well. There's a series of scenes which takes place, and they describe somebody as going south in a situation that I'm 85% sure you'd be going north.
Oh, man.
And in order to accomplish this thing. So it's like, there's still things like that. So that's a copy editing type thing. And there's also, there were just a lot more proofreading errors than usual. Why? Because there were people, because the first book in that series was so good and got so much buzz, I'm sure they were rushing to complete this next book. And so it's like, I understand that they are trying to do something, but at the same time, there's a certain kind of, like, I feel like they don't do a service to the reader in the end, or to the, like, the writer. It's like, yeah, so it's like my brain is, like, the whole time I'm reading books, I've been writing a couple rom-coms, and so I've been reading rom-coms to help me. So I read a whole bunch that were, like, published within, like, the last 6 years or something, and 85% of them have very low stakes and insufficient obstacles in the book to the degree that you, like, I can predict what's going to happen the rest of the book. I skim the rest of the book I predicted correctly and then just put it aside.
Oh, man.
Because I was like, there's just no tension there. There's no, like, suspense. So there, I do think that my brain has kind of been disturbed by all the editing over time.
Well, some of the probably same, because they talk about how they cut down in all these publishing houses. They've been cutting down budget-wise, they've been cutting down on hires and stuff like that. But it does, as a writer, I wouldn't want my stuff going out there if it's sure one or two mistakes are going to get in there. And we know that you read it so many times and mistakes still get through. But it's just the ones that are really obvious that are just, it's like, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I love actually, like, that one of the things, it's also in genre fiction again, where I've seen it the most, is that the people who have fans who are there, like, involved with their Patreon, or the people, the fan base, where they've built up relationships with these people from the beginning of their careers.
Right.
And they let them look at, like, the arcs and stuff, and those people are helping them catch the errors. And it's not the professionals catching all of them. In some cases, it's these beta readers, or they're not even beta readers, but, like, whatever. They're people who are reading, like, you know, the 10th draft or something that's about to get published. And those people are, like, you know, I think one of the reasons they let people do this as a perk is because they benefit so much from having their work appear really polished and professional.
Yeah, you need someone outside the blinders to look at it, basically.
Like, I think Brandon Sanderson does this now. Mary Robinette Cowell, I think, does this now. There's a few people, and they really, it's like, yeah, those people are really giving them a help, a big hand. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that is worth it, because you want your work to be as best as it can possibly be. So,
yeah, you know, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Wow. Oh, so much good stuff here. Not by choice, but by time, we're gonna have to wrap up now. Even though it's so interesting, especially with this whole process. But I always end off with the fill in the blanks of, I love it when writers, authors, editors, publishers, stories do X, and I really don't like when they do X. So how would you fill in the blank for those ones?
So yeah, my favorite thing is, I love it when the author torments their main character.
Oh, oh dear.
My favorite example is, there's a Dara Horn book called All Other Nights, On All Other Nights. And that book, she puts this main character through so many awful things. And every time you think he is in the worst possible situation he could possibly get in, something else piles on. And I just remember, like, it's almost as if I'm watching this with astonishment as I'm reading. Like, she's amazing. That was amazing.
Wow.
And there's, there's a science fiction writer, Cameron Hurley. She lets really bad things happen to her characters. And it's really, like, it just adds to the drama, and you're, like, so much more like, oh, my poor baby, don't let this bad thing happen. And you want, like, you have that feeling you're, like, emotionally attached to the character. It's good stuff.
Well, do you still allow, are you still looking for the happy ending to happen, or a good, optimistic
ending? At least I want some kind of resolution. I do prefer a happy ending.
Okay.
But in the meantime, yeah. In the meantime, I want torture.
Oh, jeez. What would you say for the opposite? Like, I really don't like it when stories, writers, editors, publishers, however you want to... What would you fill in the blank for that one? I really don't like when they do X.
I really don't like it when the writer makes it so the stakes are so low that we don't really care what happens.
Oh, yeah. That just sounded so sad. You said that and I just got, like, sad thinking about it.
It does. It made me sad. I remember being like,
who cares?
Yeah. Why am I reading this?
Yeah, especially because after writers put so much into it, you want everyone to be engaged in that story and not just like, oh, whatever. Well.
Yeah.
Well,
also, it's really... To me, it also disrespects the reader's time, because a reader, in order to read a book, I mean, I'm a pretty fast reader, but most novels will take me a couple days to read. And if I'm going to spend hours and hours reading a book, I don't want to, at the end, being like, why did I just spend all my time doing that?
Yeah, that's very disappointing when that occurs.
Yeah.
That occurs, yeah.
You know, all the more so if you paid for the book, like if you buy the book and that happens, ugh.
Yeah. Oh man, so true. So true. Well, on that happy note, I'm like, quick, find a way to end this on a more positive note. Thank you so much for joining us. That's a happy note to end on, right? We're so glad that we're able to speak with you.
Really fun.
Yay! This was a bonus episode of Oh My Word featuring writer and editor Rebecca Klempner. To find out more about Rebecca and her work, please visit the link in the episode notes. To keep track of Oh My Word podcasts and all the great stuff we're up to, find us on Instagram at Oh My Word Podcast, or please visit www.eltenenbaum.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Catch you next time.